Welcome to Crunching Tackles, where we break down the hardest hitting social issues in sports. On today's show, sports betting has quite literally never been more in the news than it is right now, and we have a lot to say on the matter. My name is Chad Wiley, and with me, as always, is John Nekrasov. And John, usually I would start this podcast with a political joke, but I decided that I wanted to kind of stay true to the theme of what we're discussing today. So I would like you to guess, behind Donald Trump and Joe Biden, who has the third highest odds to be president of the United States in 2024, according to the odds, to the actual presidential election odds makers?
This is a fascinating question to start the podcast with, and I'm very much here for it. Can I ask a qualifying question?
Sure. Yeah.
Is this someone who has voiced interest in running for office in any way, shape, or form? No, it's not.
Robert Kennedy Jr. is fourth.
Oh, so he's not third. Okay, because that's obviously where I would go next, because I would assume that would be the natural choice.
Good assumption, but no.
Can I ask another question?
Sure.
Is this person an athlete?
No.
They're not an athlete. Are they an actor?
No.
No, not an actor either.
I would describe them as a political figure, although not a candidate for office.
I mean, is it Michelle Obama?
It is. Yeah, she's she's third.
Okay. It was actually a pretty obvious favorite.
And Donald Trump is the favorite to be president, according to the odds makers. So
I mean, does that surprise you?
No. I just thought it was interesting. Yeah. Yeah. But in case you can't tell, we're gonna be talking about sports gambling and other types of gambling on today's pod. But John, how are you doing?
I'm good. We are locked into March Madness. We're going to be talking all things, you know, technology and, you know, the ways that we try to abstract ourselves from our sports through various things like brackets, which is just a great segue to talk about the fact that our brackets are doing incredibly well, given, I think, that last episode we talked about how completely unprepared we were for March Madness. I feel pretty good halfway. You know, we're two rounds in. It's been pretty chalky. But it's been fun. I don't know. How have you been with it?
No, I mean, I think we've both put in a pretty good showing. I would like to give a very, very special shout out to my wife and my two friends who not only came over to watch 5 hours of college basketball on Saturday, but then stuck around for another hour and a half to watch Formula One racing at midnight Eastern time. And we watched the Australian Grand Prix on Saturday night from midnight to about 1:45 a.m. And it was an amazing race. And Max Verstappen did not win. And so, I mean, I have been literally just inundating myself with the sports. And as soon as the basketball was over, I was very happy to turn my attention over to my other favorite sport at the moment.
Yeah, I think that's remarkable, given that it seems like every time I hear about Formula One, Max Verstappen wins. You know, maybe this is a sign that his inner camp troubles are catching up to him in some way. But in terms of the basketball, Chad, unlike last year, which was incredibly exciting and felt like there was an upset, like literally every other game, all the one seeds are still in. It feels like most of the big teams, with the exception of Kentucky, are still in the running. And I don't know. It's been an interesting year, but I don't feel like we have, with the exception of like maybe NC State, a like real Cinderella of in the traditional way that we think about it. And I don't feel like there are a lot of storylines where I'm like, this tournament has a life of its own. It's just been good basketball. But I don't know. It has felt like an extension kind of what we talked about a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, I think that a lot of the games themselves have been high quality. But I do agree with you that the overall vibe has been like a bit lower the opening weekend. There was no 14 or 15 seed that went on a big run or anything. But I am excited for a tournament that in its opening weekend had a lot of close and competitive games, multiple overtime games. But now in the second weekend is kind of paving the way for what I'm hoping is a really, really awesome week of basketball this weekend. I think that because for the most part, the top ranked teams have been winning, that means that we're going to get a lot of big school on big school action here in the second, in the, here in the Sweet 16 and the Elite Eight. And I think that's going to be really exciting.
Yeah, no, I'm stoked. I mean, looking down the bracket right now, I mean, Creighton, Tennessee, Purdue, Gonzaga, UNC, Alabama, Houston, Duke are all like, and the rest of the matchups are good too, but those are all like heavyweight matchups that will be really interesting to watch. So I'm excited for that. You're right. Do you still feel good about UNC? You picked UNC to win. I picked UConn to win. Do you feel like, you know, they, those two schools may be in the Final Four, and, you know, I think the favorite for winning the tournament would come out of that one, but I don't know.
I think that's right. I think that people have had a lot of good reason to be skeptical of UNC, particularly compared to the other 3-1 seeds in the tournament. However, with that said, I think that a lot of people kind of put UNC on upset alert when they got paired with Michigan State in the round of 32. Michigan State's a good school. That's a historic rivalry in the NCAA tournament. And I was listening to several people say, you know, this could be a bit of a trap game for UNC. And I think that UNC's second half performance against Michigan State, when they really, really kind of put the clamps on them defensively and scored well, I guess the short answer to the question is I do feel good. I obviously picked UNC in the bracket. That was a heart pick. I never like to be in a position where I'm cheering against my bracket, if that makes sense.
Right.
So I always try, if my team is good enough, I do try to pick them to win. I would not expect them necessarily to beat UConn, although I think it's possible. I do think that we are better compared to the other 3-1 seeds than most people are giving us credit for.
I think that's very fair. I think y'all have looked good. I think we are looking at a lot of heavyweight matchups at the end of this bracket that are going to be hard to call. You know, I always expect Purdue to sort of like start to crash out at some point. There's still the opportunity for that to happen, but they've looked pretty good in their first two games. And I'm, you know, Gonzaga looked great against Kansas, and Kansas, you know, had an early collapse in the second half of that game against Gonzaga. But, you know, Gonzaga-Purdue is not a game where I feel super confident that the Zags are going to pull that out. So it's going to be interesting. My shout out of the tournament is to NC State center DJ Burns, who is just my favorite player in college basketball right now. He has the feet of a ballet dancer and the body of an offensive lineman.
He's a big guy.
I'm obsessed. Everything he does in the court, I am just so tuned into. So I hope NC State goes all the way. I think that would be a hilarious story. I don't know that I expect them to, but I want it deeply.
Yeah, he's a big man and he's got a good game. So if NC State wins, I believe that they have a potential matchup with Duke in the Elite Eight. If Duke would have to beat the number one seed, Houston, I think. And so, but that would be obviously for the area in which I reside, a pretty significant event if that could take place. So
we will root for that just for the drama. And
yeah.
Hopefully for the traffic.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, fun tournament. Really fun.
That'll be good.
I hope that I'm able to watch a little bit more of the women's tournament as well. I haven't watched any of the women's games yet, but obviously they're going on concurrently to each other. So there's plenty of basketball to dive into, and I hope that the games continue to be as good as they already have been.
Do we want to get to the big story? Because we have a big story, and I don't know. This has been one of the most, just like, not to use the cliche, but genuinely out of left field stories that I feel like we've covered on this podcast in our entire time.
Wow,
covering sports.
Look at the baseball reference from you.
I know. I mean, it wasn't intentional, but like, but I just feel like it's accurate. Like,
yeah.
It's one of the strangest things I feel like that's ever happened in my memory in professional sports in the last couple of decades.
Yeah, I think that our big story has kind of changed from the last time we podcasted. We were already planning on doing a podcast about sports gambling, kind of in the wake of me sharing my own very limited experience, short-lived experience, I would say, with sports gambling. Didn't last very long. And so we were already kind of starting to think about what this story would look like. There have obviously been huge suspensions in the NFL in recent years related to gambling. Historically, baseball has had issues with gambling going all the way back to Pete Rose. And even before that with the Chicago Black Sox. So plenty to talk about historically. And then I think the news kind of decided what our truly big story was going to be, mm-hmm. which is the honestly continent-spanning saga surrounding the Los Angeles Dodgers and a personal favorite of this podcast, Shohei Ohtani. Would you like me to kind of give the full timeline of what's going on here, and then we can kind of talk about what Ohtani said today, or what's the best way to kind of catch people up on this?
I think we should talk through the timeline because it's weird, and facts conflicted a lot, but I think it's worth going through that, and then I think we should kind of talk about his statement today because Ohtani spoke to the press, and then react from there.
Okay. Please stop me at any point if I get anything wrong. I'm doing this from memory after all of my reading, so here we go. ESPN received information that wire transfers had been made from one of Shohei Ohtani's bank accounts to a sports betting agency. And in the process of trying to get in touch with Shohei Ohtani, they spoke to his interpreter, who gave a long interview with ESPN, in which he, Shohei Ohtani's interpreter who's employed by the Dodgers for the purpose of translating between Japanese and English for Ohtani, admitted that he had amassed massive gambling debts to the tune of about $4.5 million. And he claimed to ESPN that he had told Ohtani about it and that Ohtani had obviously been upset but had agreed to help him pay off his debts, and that he and Ohtani had wire transferred $500,000 in $5,000 increments at various points, money from Ohtani's account to the bookies. As the story got closer and closer to breaking after he did this interview, the Los Angeles Dodgers team announced this to the team that the story was going to take place, and it seems like this was the first time that Shohei Ohtani had ever heard about it, because apparently right after, I should just say this was happening while the Dodgers were in Korea to begin the MLB regular season playing against the San Diego Padres. And so while they're in Korea, this gets announced to the team. Shohei Ohtani is confused about what's going on, and he asks what they were discussing, and they told him about what the interpreter had said. And he basically said that that's not true. He said that Shohei Ohtani said that he had never agreed to make payments on behalf of his interpreter, and that, in fact, he did not even know that this was going on. So at that point, ESPN get in touch with the interpreter once again for an interview. And at this point, he admits that he had never told Ohtani and had basically taken the money out of Ohtani's account himself. And so he was accused of fraud and theft and was immediately terminated by the Los Angeles Dodgers. And the MLB has opened an investigation into the situation. And I think that kind of catches us up. And we can talk about now today being the first time that Ohtani has spoken to the media since this.
That's exactly right. So just for context, right? Ohtani is, I think at this point, the best played player in baseball. He's one of the highest profile athletes in the world. You know, I think we can't, given how much we just recently talked about him and the generational talent he is, and the generational impact that he could have on the sport of baseball, I think we can't overstate how big of a deal this is. This is like, in terms of talent, you know, a Lionel Messi, LeBron James, like type of player, in terms of what they can produce. And you know, his impact on the sport of baseball as the best player in the sport of baseball, like, again, can't be overemphasized. So the fact that this scandal is touching him at all is a huge deal, and it's a remarkable deal, and it's frankly shocking. And so I think, like, setting the stage there, right, like this, you know, I think understanding if you go onto Twitter right now and go onto the news and look at all the op-eds that are running around about this story right now, there are so many conflicting opinions and interpretations of the facts, because, you know, everyone immediately says, like, if Ohtani is actually implicated in this in some way, that is a nightmare scenario, obviously for himself, also for the Los Angeles Dodgers, and also for the MLB. And so, you know, it's we immediately get a story, right, from ESPN that then basically kind of is walked back, right, because the interpreter, Ipe Mizuhara, essentially says that he lied, right? We don't have all the facts yet. But we do now have, like you said earlier, a statement from Shohei Ohtani to the press, which he gave this afternoon on Monday. And in short, I mean, he cut a very depressed figure up, you know, in the media room as his interpreter, his new interpreter, was talking. And I think it's also important to say that Mizuhara, his interpreter, was a very close friend of Ohtani's, who appeared in public with him all the time, was a very public-facing figure, and it seems like Ohtani trusted him implicitly with, like, all areas of his life, it seems like. Like, he was his go-between between Ohtani and the rest of the world, essentially. And Ohtani came out today and basically said, Mizuhara lied to me repeatedly for basically a few years, stole money from him. Ohtani emphasized repeatedly that he has never placed bets of any kind on anything, which, especially on baseball, which is something that, you know, people have started to wonder. Like, what if Ohtani was going through this guy to bet himself? Plenty of other athletes have done sports gambling, right? I think that's, like, the worst case. The worst case scenario for everyone is that Mizuhara is a fall guy for Ohtani sports gambling. The best case for Ohtani is that he was being robbed. And that's his side of the story. So I don't know. Maybe we can start with what your reaction is to this story. Like, where do you feel like we are, and where do you feel like this is going to go?
Yeah, I love that question. And in my mind, there's two parts of it. Mm-hmm. The first part is that, well, I guess first is the question of, do you take Ohtani at his word? Because if you do, then the story is still significant. Obviously, it's an MLB player, a very, very famous person being the victim of a robbery. And also, we should have a conversation about the various types of roles of people who should not be gambling. And I think an interpreter who has insider knowledge of a team, sports betting is an implicit problem. That's obviously, though, a lesser story to the idea of Ohtani having some sort of knowledge or even agreement with the betting. I think, much like Major League Baseball, I think my personal impulse is to want to be defensive of Ohtani mm-hmm. as just a fan favorite of his. I'm just a big fan. Yeah. And I do think that the fact that his interpreter immediately walked it back and admitted to lying is a big piece of evidence in Ohtani's favor. I think also, just the cultural and language barrier that Ohtani has with the rest of the Western world seems like it would be a pretty significant thing. You know, the questions could, like, does he even have knowledge of the rules when it comes to sports gambling, anything like that? I do think my only skepticism comes from the fact that, like, I can't imagine having so much money that you don't notice 4.5 million of your dollars going missing. Mm-hmm. Like, that is inherently weird. And I don't understand his financial situation. Maybe he has a financial broker who takes care of all that and he just gets an allowance or a trust fund. I have no idea. I genuinely have no idea. But the idea that he would just not notice and no one would flag that 9 payments of $500,000 went out of his account to a broker and no one knew about it besides the interpreter is, to me, inherently suspicious. Right. And that's not to say that Shohei Ohtani was sports gambling and using his interpreter as a cover. I don't think I believe that. But I do think that there is more to this story than we know.
I do think that's interesting. I think that, I mean, you bring up him having someone manage his finances. We don't know. You would think that if someone was paid solely to manage his finances, that they would notice also $4.5 million just disappearing. Even I would assume that it's even more likely that they would notice. You know, so I think you're right. I think there probably is more to this story than necessarily meets the eye. But I think thinking about motive is interesting. And what Ohtani's, I don't know, I guess in my mind, if Ohtani really did help out Mizuhara, like, you know, in the kind of the best case scenario for Mizuhara, where he had a gambling debt, which also we should say, sports gambling is illegal in California. So this was not legal sports betting. So this was going through an illegal bookie.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if Mizuhara had racked up this debt on his own, went to Ohtani and was like, hey, can you pay my debts? Ohtani coming in and saying, you stole from me. I don't know what Mizuhara's, you know, benefit from not like countering that narrative would be, you know, right. Unless he was paid, unless like the most nefarious thing happened and Ohtani paid him off with even more money mm-hmm. than he would have had before. I mean, I guess mm-hmm. that's possible, but to me that seems like a more complicated and strange answer than Mizuhara, you know, holding most of the blame here, if not all.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's exactly right. And obviously anything that we say beyond what we know officially is going to just be speculation. Right. And we could speculate about what Ohtani knew. We can speculate about his interpreter's motives. There's also, I think, the interesting angle of the fact that Ohtani is saying that is kind of like this, there's a friendship kind of falling apart. If we mm-hmm. if we take their friendship at its word, right. that they were very close, that Ohtani and his interpreter had a close bond, there's just a level of either a complete falling out or some sort of falling out of trust. Or, I mean, we can speculate to the idea of that there is something more nefarious and that his interpreter is taking the fall. I would just say, and again, I think that Ohtani being a non-English speaking Japanese person kind of goes to his favor in this way in a little bit and gives him a little bit of credit just in terms of anything that could be inferred about his intentions. Mm-hmm. You know, even if he had been asked to pay off the debts, I don't think we can reasonably assume that he would have even known that it was illegal or wrong. He's not native to our culture. There's a language barrier there. Like, I think that when he's meeting with MLB officials or other things, he's going to be able to take a lot of plausible deniability. And obviously, my hope is that he is completely innocent just on the merits of it, and that he was the victim of a robbery, and that this won't be in any way a tarnishing part of his career. Mm-hmm. But, and I'll let you respond, but I guess to me, my biggest takeaway here is that with the facts we know and with the facts we don't know, the fact is sports gambling, illegal or legal, when it's blended with sports, creates more drama than it's worth in almost mm-hmm. every single situation. And this is the ultimate example of that.
I mean, I think it's absolutely right. I think just one note on what you said about his plausible deniability that I think is interesting. You know, because there's only so much you can lean, I think, on being like, I'm not from here. You know, when I think as a player, I think it'd be pretty obvious that you can't be betting, especially on your own sport, right? Which even Mizuhara said that he didn't bet on baseball, supposedly.
Well, I agree with that. I'm more so referring to if he had been asked to pay off his interpreter's debts.
Right. Well, what I was gonna say is that I think he can really lean on the fact that his interpreter is the cultural lens, right, that he's viewing America and the law through. And I think that is something that, you know, if this came to some kind of lawsuit, you know, being deliberately misled by your interpreter, I can imagine being a strong argument in Ohtani's case.
That's a huge point.
So, I don't know. I think the cards are very stacked in Ohtani's favor, to be honest. As much of a mess as this story is, I think people will want to not take him at his word, you know, because there's just always haters around.
Sure.
But I think the majority of people, and also baseball as a sport, definitely want this story to go away as fast as possible. And I think that there is just the one question mark, right? You know, would the MLB try to sweep this under the rug as fast as possible? In the worst case scenario, you know, where they had to like ban Ohtani or something, would they use this dude as a fall guy? It's possible, but we'll never know, I don't think, unless yeah. like the federal government got involved, and that would be like the biggest scandal in baseball history and maybe even sports history. So, 100%. You know, I really don't think that's what happened here, to be totally honest. That seems extremely unlikely. But I do feel like it should be at least called out as a possibility. Never take, you know, press statements at their word. That's our job as journalists, yeah. you know. But at the same time, I think both of us lean toward saying that this is a really sad story that implicates one of our best athletes.
Yeah.
And it's just it really, does point us. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm a naturally judgmental person in general, but in this case, and possibly in this case only, Ohtani is not only innocent until proven guilty in the eyes of the law, he's also innocent until proven guilty in my heart.
I guess that's what's interesting to me is like, I mean, I honestly don't know a whole lot about Shohei Ohtani's character because he doesn't really give us a lot of insight into his personal life, but he seems like a really nice guy from what we see of him. And also the fact that his interpreter would go through all the work of being like, Ohtani hates gambling repeatedly in all these stories seems to me like it would be pretty easy to find dirt on this guy if he was actually like a serious gambler under the covers.
Yeah, I think
so. I don't, especially since it's illegal in California, you know, I think if the government got involved in this, like, I think if there was worry that Ohtani was actually involved in a betting way, I think that would come out pretty fast, to be honest. So,
yeah. Well, John, should we broaden the conversation from here?
I think we should, because I think what is strange about this story, and you said it a little bit ago, is that it points us to, I don't know, just really the how it is the biggest example in recent memory of a problem that in many ways has plagued society since human civilization has existed, which is betting on sports, funnily enough.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, sports gambling has existed since the age of the Circus Maximus, when Romans raced chariots around an arena. People gambled on sports back then and lost money on sports back then. So this is, in many ways, not just a modern sports problem, but a human problem. And I think we kind of want to talk about, you know, maybe not so much about Roman sports betting and maybe more about kind of how the modern wave of
American
sports betting. I mean, I think all that stuff is really important. I think it tells us a lot about how, I mean, ultimately human this problem is and this impulse is.
Yeah.
But I do think that what brings us here, right, is the fact that in the last 6 years since sports betting was legalized federally in the U.S., you know, it has taken over the sports world, and the sports world is something that we love dearly here on Crunching Tackles. I think we both think that it's important to talk about.
Yeah. So just to kind of set the scene of what the world is that we're talking about, in 2023, approximately $120 billion worth of legal sports bets were placed in the USA. That number is going to be higher this year because more and more states have legalized betting. And that number does not account for the illegal gambling market, which some estimate as being as much, if not more, profitable than the actual legal market at this point. So we're talking about a very, very significant flow of commerce in our culture. And John's point about this dating back to the gladiators and the chariot races is the fact that this is not just a uniquely American cultural phenomenon. This is something that is ingrained in human nature and is something that is visible in almost every country on Earth in almost every period of the history of Earth.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think it's, I don't know, do you want to start by talking about why? Like, that's honestly the question that to me that like almost interests me the most. Like,
yeah,
there's there's something strange, and we've talked about this week because of our brackets. There's something about sports that seem to make people want to abstract themselves from the sport in some way and compete against each other through the watching of a sport.
Yeah.
Which is like a funny way of putting it, but like whether you're playing fantasy football or making a bracket or gambling, there is this natural urge, largely in male audiences. That's where most of this kind of issue is, but specifically gambling. But you know, there is a natural desire, it seems like, to use knowledge or chance in some way to make your experience of watching a sport more intense.
Mm-hmm.
To give yourself a deeper personal interest than you already have. And I think what we're going to talk about today is how digitizing that has made that a much more pressing issue, I think, than it ever has been in modern society or in any society. But it is something that's not new at all. I think we need to think about it in that way. You know, this is not caused solely by big betting companies. This is something that's always been here in some way. And I think that's kind of odd. Why do you think we do that? Just like as a baseline philosophical question.
Yeah. So I think there are two answers. One is a human nature question, and then one is a sports question. And the human nature part is that it's worth remembering that sports gambling is just a subset of gambling, right?
Right. Right.
And so, like there is a human nature to play games of chance for the potential of profit. Mm-hmm. That goes beyond sports, and sports is one venue for that kind of behavior. I have a grandpa who never had a gambling problem or anything like that, but like 6 or 7 times a year, he would just buy a lottery ticket for like 20 years, and he never mm-hmm. won ever, but he would buy it. And he would check it and he would lose and then he would forget about it. And then a couple months later, he would do it again. And I was always like, Grandpa, like, why are you doing that? And he was like, well, who knows? You never know when you're going to be the one. And so there is just like that human element of like a very, very small chance at a huge payout. Mm-hmm. Life-changing money is very tempting. And I think that's definitely part of it, that people think that this is a way that they can actually make it big. Now, in my research about this topic today, I came across a really interesting survey that kind of ties it to sports directly, which is that between 80 and 90% of young adults, like ages 18 to 25, believe that sports betting is skill and not luck. And I think that's super interesting because when it comes to sports, there is an element of it to which people think that their own knowledge of a sport can guarantee them success. Similarly to fantasy or other things, that you actually are proving your knowledge of a sport by how well you're doing. And for many reasons, I strongly disagree with that assessment. Mm-hmm. I think that 80 to 90% are dead wrong. But I do think there is a sense of pride in sports knowledge that leads people to think, because I watch a lot of basketball, I know that I'll be good at this because I can beat the odds because I'm smart about the sport or whatever.
Mm-hmm. I think there's a very natural tie to another activity that is very common and that, you know, maybe feels more official. And so we kind of chalk it off. But I mean, obviously the stock market in many ways involves, you know, taking chances with money on quote unquote teams, you know? And I think, you know, you see, you know, young people trading in crypto mm-hmm. all the time everywhere. Mm-hmm. Right. And I think there is a natural impulse specifically because of the internet now that we can amass information on a certain thing or a certain topic and say like, you're exactly right. You know, my skill got me here. And I think I always like find that really funny. Because when you look at the people who, you know, who really play the game, who are the analysts who like spend all their time building statistical models for making good brackets, those people should have the best brackets every year. And invariably, it's just as random as almost anyone else.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's why sports are fun, is because sports are random. March Madness is fun, right? You like making a perfect bracket is almost impossible.
No, it is impossible. No one's ever done it.
Yeah. And so like, you know, getting to that point is very, very difficult to even be successful, right? To have a predictable way to create success. And so obviously with sports betting, it's the exact same thing. But I think you're right that there's something in us that like, that wants that success, that always says, you know, one more try and I can, I'll do it better this time. And that I think is where basically the psychology of the human brain steps in.
Yeah. Well, I think the idea of a one more try mentality kind of goes into the addiction element as opposed to just the why people gamble. The thing I like to keep in mind, John, and this is just like accepting my place on the hierarchy humbly, is the fact that anyone, and I mean this almost literally, anyone who has ever shown any ability to consistently beat sports betting odds are not sports bettors, they are odds makers. Because the casinos hire them to do this because they are smarter than the rest of us.
Right.
So the idea that like there are these brilliant people who are just cracking the code of sports gambling, that's not true. The people who are literally the best at this are the ones who are making sure that FanDuel and DraftKings and ESPN Bets and MGM and Caesars are the ones making the money by setting the best odds that they can. Which is why inherently I do believe that for the average and even above average sports consumer, sports betting can only be a game of luck because the playing field is leveled by the geniuses and the computer wizards and the data analysts and just the very, very good gamblers who are now in the pockets of the casinos making sure that they're the ones who make the money.
Right. I mean, it's a game. And I think when we think about the history of sports gambling, you know, in a lot of societies, this was illegal for a reason. And this was illegal in most of our society for a long time because bookmakers were illegally setting the playing field, you know, against these people and then robbing them of all their money.
Yeah.
And I think this is where, you know, the impulse, there's something exciting about being like, I can win lots of money by being good at something, being good at cards, being good at guessing, you know, which dog is going to win in a dog fight, as terrible as it is, or, you know, which horse is going to win a race or who is going to score a touchdown in a football game. There is something, there is a dopamine rush you get there in succeeding. We talked about this a little bit. With your betting experience a couple of weeks ago, and this is what really concerns me. You know, when we talk about social media and the ways that, you know, social media companies basically use our attention as currency, right? That's something we talk about all the time in society these days. You know, that the cell phone is like reorienting your mind to like require the dopamine of scrolling to just function normally. What modern sports gambling does is it takes that same impulse and then it says, what if you can make or lose money based on that dopamine, right? And what we are seeing in a lot of studies right now is that that essentially gambling addiction that, you know, can happen anywhere. You can go to a casino and develop a gambling addiction and lose all your money. Now you can do it on your phone without leaving your house. And we are seeing statistics about young people and college students especially that are frankly staggering.
Yeah.
There was a study quoted by Time Magazine, you know, which is probably the most extreme study I've seen so far. So, you know, take these numbers with a grain of salt. But one study at, I think it was University of Buffalo, cited 10% of the college students that they surveyed as what they labeled as pathological gamblers. You know, I'm sure the number is probably a little bit less than that if you extrapolate it across the entire population of young people. But still, the numbers that are coming through are staggering, in specifically among young college-aged men. You know, the article basically interviewed college counselors at the school and asked, like, what kind of issues are you seeing? And they were like, 9 times out of 10, that's not an actual stat, but like the majority of cases that they were seeing were problem gamblers who were like, I can't stop gambling on my phone.
Yeah.
And that's scary because all your money is on your phone now.
Yeah.
Right. You can lose, if you get sunk in, you can lose all your money just like that without going anywhere.
Yeah. And you, I mean, you can hide it too. Like you don't even have to. You don't even have to link your bank account. I ran my FanDuel through Venmo.
Mm-hmm.
It was that easy.
Mm-hmm.
Like it is so convenient. It is so accessible. Your stat about that amount of college students interesting. Other studies also kind of correlate gambling addiction with other types of substance abuses. That mm-hmm. it attracts people who have just general addictive personalities. It's also worth mentioning that, like, the vast, vast majority of people don't succeed in gambling, especially when they become addicted. Mm-hmm. In fact, 20% of people who have been gambling addicts, they don't just lose money. They don't just detrimentally hurt their finances. 20% actually file for bankruptcy. And while bankruptcy might be a prerequisite to be the Republican nominee for president, it's actually not a good thing.
You're crazy for that. point taken, though, genuinely, because like I just think that any activity that can that easily destroy your life without people knowing is just so dangerous. You know, like, on my moral high horse for a second, like, you know, you think about other types of substance abuse, like alcoholism or drug abuse. You know, there are obvious, like, you can hide it maybe to a good degree sometimes, but like, there are signs. If you're living with someone like that, you will know that they, in many circumstances, eventually you will find out the truth about what's going on because their physical symptoms just become impossible to hide. And you can ruin your life over time. And obviously, in some cases, you can instantly ruin your life. But the way that you impact the lives of people around you, you know, sometimes is more limited. With sports gambling, you can ruin the lives of you and your entire family almost instantaneously,
mm-hmm.
Without anyone knowing. And I think that's what's so jarring and problematic about gambling in particular, and has always, you know, it's always been the problem with gambling. But I just, like, you know, I think there's like a dopamine junkie, like, reality to this, that obviously we all, if you like sports, you engage with that emotion in some way.
Yeah.
That's like the entertainment of sports. But I think the gambling industry is weighted against people, and even if it's not necessarily, like, on its face, morally wrong, society gains nothing at all from sports gambling or gambling in general existing. I just think that's an objective fact.
I think you're 100% right. I completely agree. I don't think that's even a controversial take to say it does significantly more harm than good, and significantly more people are put into financial ruin than change their lives with profit through gambling. That's just a fact.
Right.
I think we've kind of been talking around the psychology of what makes sports betting addictive. We've mm-hmm. talked about why people do it. We talk about how it can become dangerous. But, like, I would love to just spend a couple of minutes talking about, like, what in the human psychology, particularly for people with generic, just general addictive tendencies, like, what is it about this thing that gets people sucked in? And I mentioned the part of it being knowledge-based, which is the idea that people think that they can actually beat it because of their own intelligence, that they think, oh, this is just a game and I'm good at the game, so I know I'll win because I have knowledge. But I love what you said earlier about the idea of just like, oh, just one more. And I think the most harmful thing that sports betting does is creates in people a desire to make up a loss with more gambling. Mm-hmm. And in my, I think the last time we podcasted, I was just starting my FanDuel experience. And I would like to share with you how my sports betting experience ended. Mm-hmm. I was up $50 and I placed a bet for, I think, like $5 on, or maybe it was $10 or something, on Duke and UNC to play each other in the ACC championship game. And that didn't happen, courtesy of NC State. And so I lost $5.20. And I was so angry that I lost $5.20 that I immediately cashed out my account and deleted FanDuel because I was like, "This, I'm done. I didn't like losing." Yeah. But for people who have addictive personalities, their response would have been to immediately look out for a different bet that they could make up that money on. And so the cycle becomes such that every time you lose, the only way to make up that financial loss is to gamble more and more and more. And once you get down deep enough into the cycle where you're down hundreds and then thousands and then possibly tens of thousands of dollars, not only is gambling still a like kind of like baiting the hook of being the fastest way to get out of your troubles, there comes a point where it's actually the only way to get out of your troubles because you're in so much debt. And so people talk about like snowballing debt and stuff like that. And this is literally the clearest example of that, where people become so desperate for money because they're down so much money and they are still viewing sports gambling as the only way to make more money, even as their entire lives have become a demonstration of just how impossible it is to actually win.
I think that's really well put. I think you hit the nail on the head. And I think like there's a reason that gambling was so tied into crime for so long. You know, if you watch, you know, any mafia story, right, there's gambling and bookies involved in all kinds of different ways. Because the best way that you can exploit, you know, the more that you can exploit people, who are desperate for money, you know, the better it is for the bookie. And so a criminal bookie has the most potential, right, to offer predatory odds and situations to people and then essentially destroy their lives. Obviously, you know, FanDuel is not a criminal organization. And so this operates differently, but this cycle puts people into situations where they, you know, are more likely to turn to crime in situations like that and to end up in bad situations.
Because the other ways to make up money are, because the other ways to make up that much money is drug dealing or other types of things.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And so I don't know. I think that, I mean, obviously not everyone who places sports bets is a gambling addict, and not everyone who places sports bets is going to end up in that place. Maybe you can control it and you do it periodically and you feel fine about it and you don't, you know, you set yourself limits and whatever. Like we kind of talked about at the beginning of your experience. But I think it's a sort of thing where when an industry is trying to feed your addiction to make you a worse person and a worse off person, we land in it's a hugely problematic thing. The NFL, the MLB, all of these sports leagues are trying to build an ecosystem in which you're going to give these books more money than they give you. Right? These sports industries are now being built on robbing fans of their money.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's all sports gambling ultimately is. Most mm-hmm. of the time, you know, the majority of people do not win money, net gain on gambling. And so the reality is, you know, these sports industries are increasingly being built on a toxic structure. And I think that, you know, when we think about maybe the players for a second and how this impacts players in the stories of players like Ohtani that are touched by gambling or gamble themselves, like Calvin Ridley in some way. You know, this story is just beginning in America. But I don't know. I worry for the future of the sports industry in relation to this.
Yeah. And honestly, I think like the specific elements of the sports industry and how leagues and players need to handle this could be an entirely separate podcast. Mm-hmm. I'd love to briefly touch on two things before we get there first, though. One, I literally, John, can't go on my Instagram for 30 seconds without seeing Kevin Hart's DraftKings ad and Rob Gronkowski's FanDuel ad. There are no ads that say, get your heroin here and get your sign up here to get on your crack cocaine subscription. But I mean, sports betting advertising, I would love to see what the financial number is on that, because it's crazy. They use a lot of deceptive marketing tactics. We talked about their super boosted bets last time on the podcast, how they tried to suck people in. But these are like slimy people who are preying on people. I'm not saying they're all like that, it's necessarily evil or immoral, but these are people who know the kind of harm that their product can do to people and are still putting in front of you 24/7 on your Instagram account. And I just think it's really scary from that element. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know if you have anything on that.
I mean, I just think that, like, I don't know. I want to talk in some way about, like, is there anything we can do about this? And I think like the question comes down to, like, how much is the government going to be willing to regulate this moving forward? The UK is obviously ahead of us in terms of gambling's immersion in the sports market. You know, I mean, there was a while there where every single team, it felt like, had a gambling sponsor, and there were gambling ads all over the stadium. Like, it was just like, you attend a sports match, you gamble. Those things are like synonymous. It's like gambling, drinking, sports, right? And I don't know. I think that, you know, there's been a huge push in the UK to regulate visibility of gambling, to decrease gambling advertising, you know, and I think regulators and activists have made some headway over there. And maybe that's a whole nother conversation as well, in terms of, you know, how much can you do and, you know, what is the government's role in that, in stepping into these situations and clamping down on advertising. But I do kind of think that that's a start.
Yeah. Right?
Like, I think if you have a gambling problem, you don't need help gambling more.
Yeah. They advertise obviously outside of, like, on social media, on television. But John, I was with my friend on Saturday watching basketball, multiple friends. One of my friends had placed a parlay bet on NC State. And I'd like to come back to this part as well. Placed a parlay bet on NC State. And he had his FanDuel app open during the game because he was seeing live updates of how close his parlay was getting to hitting.
Right.
And I kid you not, every 30 minutes, a pop-up notification would appear on his phone that would say, you've been on this screen for 30 minutes without placing a bet. Do you want to make one? Every 30 minutes, it did that for the entire, just reminding you, hey, you're sitting here, you could be making more money. Just go over here. Like, it came across to me as incredibly predatory. I have real, real moral issues with that. And then just to talk about, like, the fan experience related to gambling, I do think that people need to be wary of it, just from the fact that gambling is going to change the way you watch sports if you do it. Mm-hmm. And if you care about a team, you would need to think, I would really consider thinking twice before betting on them. Because, again, with my same friends on Saturday, one of my friends had bet NC State against Oakland in the round of 32. He had bet NC State on the over. The over was 6.5. So he was saying they would win by more than 7. NC State get a rebound with like 12 seconds left. They're up by 6 points. They dribble up to the front court and Oakland decide not to foul and they don't take a shot. and they win by 6 points. Mm-hmm. And my friend, who is an NC State alumni and only cares about basketball because of NC State, his first reaction was anger and sadness because his team just made the Sweet 16 by less points than he needed them to make money. Mm-hmm. And I would just like, that's just a warning to just to say, it's going to make wins, even something that should be this huge emotional high for you if you just care about your team winning or other things, like it's going to make all of that messier and more complicated. And it's honestly like kind of sad to see your friend have what without gambling would be this euphoric win, but because he had lost a bet, despite his team winning, he couldn't actually like appreciate the full moment.
I mean, that's hard. And I think we see a microcosm of that, maybe a less damaging microcosm, but you know, it's the same thing when you're playing, if you're involved in fantasy football and you have, you know, a player on a rival team, potentially on your team, right? And you're like rooting for them to somehow succeed against you while also cheering for your team, right? Like if you've played fantasy, you understand that feeling.
Yeah.
It does, like, you know, I think we talk about why sports are meaningful, aside from the competition part. Like, there's something about our relationship to our teams, and our relationship to the sport at large that does carry a lot of meaning. Like, it's a parasocial relationship. It's not the most important thing in the world or anything like that, but it does carry meaning to us. Mm-hmm. And I think, kind of wrapping back to where we started this conversation, like, when you refract your relationship with something you care about through money, that will change you, right? Just like 100%. Playing, just like being paid to play a sport changes your relationship to the sport. You know, you may still love it in the same way, but you may not, because that, you know, that thing then chews you out and takes ownership of you in some way because the money has its roots in you. I think that, you know, sports gambling is not going to go away. But I don't know. I feel like every step we take in this direction, in our sports industry takes us a step further from sports, like, being meaningful to us, as a genuine community, a community bonding experience. You know,
yeah.
And I think that's just so deeply harmful, and just contrary to, you know, if you play sports and you grew up playing, like, that feeling of winning, and bonding together and camaraderie is like what sports are all about in the end. And this really is like the antithesis of that.
Yeah, I mean, nobody has a deep emotional bond to the slot machine in Las Vegas, right?
Nope.
Like, those are they're kind of like sad, tragic places to be if you ever like look at people playing slots. And if sports becomes that, rather than, obviously there are other ways in which sports have been sucked of their emotional purity, and you and I have talked about those other things, but this is, sure. Yeah, I think you're right, another one of those ways where when sports become just another, let's say you're really, really good and you think it's skill, so just part of your financial portfolio, or at worst, like a slot machine where you're just feeding it money, hoping for a return without any guarantee of anything constantly, it's going to take all the joy out of it.
I'm just like, why watch? Genuinely.
Yeah.
What is the point?
Yeah, I think that's really good. I think that's really well said. We're about an hour in here. I wonder if we want to talk a little bit more. Obviously, we've talked about Shohei. We've talked about other players who have been suspended for gambling. Do we have more to say on players and leagues? Do we want to save that for another podcast?
I think that's a broader conversation that I think maybe we really should do a whole podcast about at some point. Maybe next time we pod, or after the March Madness pod, we revisit this and think about it. But I do just want to briefly say, like, I think there are, and I want to talk about it more in depth because I think there are legitimate, like, practical answers that leagues are going to have to come up with regarding what they're going to do. But I think the reality is that leagues have created this ecosystem because they are greedy and they want money. Mm-hmm. And they are then creating a world where their own players are incentivized to engage in this behavior, and then punishing them for living in it. And, you know, I mean, you're responsible, I think, to a degree for starting your gambling addiction. You know, but I mean, we are talking about an addictive behavior that's really dangerous and harmful to people and does become something that you can't fully control. And I think leagues treating players in the way they currently are, while also feeding the monster at the same time, is deeply hypocritical and a huge problem.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I do want to do a whole podcast about league culpability and actually propose some actual things that leagues or the government could do. Mm-hmm. Because I do think that's a bigger conversation. That could be a whole second hour. And I think that we could really, brainstorm some real insights there.
Yeah. I just also want to say, like, I mean, this becomes a player integrity issue. Mm-hmm. And I think leagues also need to think about that. Jonte Porter of the Toronto Raptors is currently under investigation by the NBA for, you know, betting irregularities in relation to his games. That's like a performance thing that he's, you know,
yeah,
alleged that the way he was playing was impacted by betting odds.
Well, yeah. So I'm not sure if the allegation is that he bet or that he leaked information. But the way that story is going is that those were nights. He had two nights where he left really, really early, like within 4 minutes due to injury. And on to both of those nights, all of the unders were bet for his stat lines. And so he was, I think, the largest profited player on both of those nights that people won bets off of, whether it was him directly betting or him sharing information about his availability to people who were betting. It's just, yeah, it's a huge, huge integrity issue.
Mm-hmm. And I think this is my last thought on this. Takes me back to Ohtani. You know, you do see really rich people sometimes who get stuck in gambling. You know, but I think a lot of times the people who have an unbelievably high income really don't need to gamble, right? Like Ohtani, unless he just has, you know, the psychological drive, Ohtani does not need the money, being on basically one of the largest sports contracts in world history ever.
Yeah.
The people who are at risk are the bit part players who are on much lower salaries and are involved in the sports world, but don't make that kind of money and are still trying to get by and can easily get in a hole.
And a referees.
Player like Porter, and a player like Porter, we've seen that story happen countless times. So
yeah. I think my last thought, I'm kind of feeling out my own mood right now. And I feel very similarly to like how I feel talking about Saudi Arabia on this podcast or other things like that. And I'm not trying to say that FanDuel is morally comparable to Mohammed bin Salman or whatever, but I think it's crystal clear in my mind that sports gambling is going to do much more tangible damage to people's lives here in America than Saudi Arabia will do. Mm-hmm. Thousands of people are going to lose everything they have in America due to this in the next 5-10 years. Thousands of people. And you might have a friend or a family member who's going to be one of them. And so, like, I feel so strongly that if anyone listening to this podcast somewhere down the line becomes a sports gambler, it's not going to be because they weren't warned repeatedly about it on this podcast. Like, I really am going to continue talking about this because it's so crystal clear in my mind how much harm this is inevitably going to do. There's no if about it. It is going to do incredible harm to people.
Yeah, I think that's really important and really well said. I find it very sad.
Yeah.
To be honest. And I think, like, I don't have a problem saying that. And I think the longer the longer we see this industry take root, I think the clearer that becomes. And so, like, I don't know. I think I would encourage people, you know, don't gamble. You know, that would be my encouragement to you. I think it's not healthy. I'm not going to police your behavior, obviously, but I don't know. I would just say that I think maybe even more than that, like, we all need to be thinking, if you're a sports fan, we all need to be thinking about the ways, not only the gambling impacts your behavior, but also the ways that, you know, we can push back on this, because the force of the sports industry is very much against us in this way. Yeah. And I think it's a force that is trying to actively harm you. And I think if you're not thinking critically about that, I think that's a really bad thing.
This has been another bright and cheery episode of the Crunching Tackles podcast.
I feel like we thrive at that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, to leave this on a positive note, I just want to say again, I'm getting ready to enjoy so much basketball this week. So much really, really, really good basketball. And I'm going to enjoy it more because I will have zero financial investment in the outcome of any of these games. I will enjoy them as games. I will enjoy the UNC game as a fan. Mm-hmm. And I will not be worried about what this is going to do to my bank account or anything like that, or freaking out, because I'm just going to be able to enjoy sports the way that they're supposed to be enjoyed. And I would invite everyone else to just do the same thing. Let's just keep this fun. It's sports. It's what sports have always been. I don't know. It doesn't seem that hard to me. It really doesn't. I tried this gambling thing. It didn't stick. It wasn't fun.
Chad beat gambling. I was a little worried about you 2 weeks ago, to be honest.
Were you? Were you really?
Not actually, but like,
okay.
I was intrigued. Yeah. The character arc, it was just a new thing, you know?
It was weird.
But you tried it out, and I think it gave us content. So in that way, you know, we are, Crunching Tackles is a content machine that's willing to try things out for the benefit of people.
I didn't gamble for me. I gambled for you. You, John, and you, the listeners. You're welcome.
I don't know. I feel like that's a great note to end this on, because we will come back to this, I think, with more actionable points.
Yeah.
But if you're listening to this, you know, I really think that this, of any of the things, you know, there have been a few topics we've talked about where I'm like, I want your feedback as a listener. This is one of the few things where, like, really, we want to hear your thoughts about this. And how this has impacted you. If you're listening, share it with your friends. Talk about it. This is an issue that will not go away. And like Chad said, is, you know, one of the, perhaps, I don't know about the most, but one of the, like, top three most personally impactful stories to you, I think, that we've probably covered on this podcast in terms of your actionable life. And for that reason, I think it's very important. So,
yeah, I think so. If you're gambling and you're somehow doing well, I want to hear from you. If you're also not gambling, I want to hear why. Like, no matter what your approach to the story is, like, I want to know how this is going for you. And I honestly would love to hear from someone who's casually gambling and winning and having a great emotional time, because I would love to hear your perspective too. Just please let us know.
Yep. And with that submission, I don't know, do you, we're going to talk about our brackets now for the next week, right?
No, I think so. Yeah. It is worth stating that John and I have both been, maybe ignorance is excellence when it comes to college basketball, because we've been pretty dialed in. I was surprised by how my bracket has come together here. So,
mm-hmm. But yeah, I think stay tuned. Because we will have a podcast to come, you know, summarizing March Madness when we think about it. And I think the next episode after that, assuming that a huge breaking story doesn't happen, which it probably will, but assuming that does not happen, we will have a conversation, I think, about the legal ramifications of what's going to happen. I want to take a close look at the UK regulations and think about, how that may end up applying in the US. And I really do want to hear what you, the listener, thinks about, you know, where we go from here. Whether you engage in sports gambling or not, if you're like, y'all are dead wrong and I should be able to do what I want with my money, let us know.
Yeah, I want to study up on this, and I want to come with like real tangible policy proposals. So that will be coming soon on
Stay tuned
Crunching Tackles podcast.
For crunching legislature.
Yeah. I think the next time that we pod will probably be on April 9th, which is going to be the day after UNC wins the national championship game.
That's exactly right.
And so I can't wait for that. And if that comes true, I'm going to be absolutely insufferable on Tuesday night. And I can't wait to share that with you.
Do I want to root for you or not? I can't decide yet.
You're going to have to think about that morally and from a content perspective. That could go either way as far as I'm concerned.
Well, until that time, I very much look forward to it.
Until then, John, I hope that you all continue to be well and be safe, and we'll talk to you later.
All right. Cheers, guys.